Presented by Donald MacLeod.
Thank you very much. It's always a great pleasure and a privilege to welcome one of the world's truly great orchestras to the Proms, and few have a longer and more distinguished tradition than the ensemble just taking their places on the platform here in the Royal Albert Hall. The Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra is giving the first of two Proms with their music director since 2005, Ricardo Chailly. The orchestra can certainly boast a very illustrious name call of previous chief conductors, but few orchestras can lay claim to having been directed by as magisterial a musical figure as the composer Felix Mendelssohn. In the 1830s and 40s, he took over what was already an ensemble with a very good reputation and turned it into one of the finest in Germany. In homage to his famous predecessor, in this first concert, Ricardo Chailly is going to be conducting a programme entirely of music by Mendelssohn. After the interval, we'll hear them in his Fifth Symphony, The Reformation, as it's never been heard in this country before. So, a UK Mendelssohn premiere then. Well, that's preceded by an overture Mendelssohn himself had a special place for, but which we rarely hear in the concert hall, The Fair Melusina. In part one, the orchestra is going to be joined in a few minutes by the dynamic young Danish-born violinist Nikolaj Snyder to play the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto. But first, we'll hear them in a more familiar overture. Mendelssohn was commissioned to provide incidental music for a charity performance of Victor Hugo's play Ruy Blas in 1839, rather. Hugo had only written it the previous year, but Mendelssohn wasn't impressed. He told his mother he found the play utterly wretched and beneath contempt. At the 11th hour, he relented and decided to turn out an overture at top speed and had the parts copied out all in less than 6 days. And when he heard the results, he announced, "I enjoyed it nearly as much as anything I've done." Here is Ricardo Chailly joining the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra and their concertmaster Christian Funker on the platform of the Royal Albert Hall to perform Mendelssohn's overture to Ruy Blas. In Mendelssohn's overture to Victor Hugo's play, Ruy Blas, we heard the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra opening their prom, conducted by their music director, Ricardo Chailly. And that was also a UK premiere, by the way, the first of three tonight. We heard it in its original, restoring a number of the changes Mendelssohn made before the score was published. And there is a Leipzig connection. Mendelssohn composed that overture for a performance of the play being put on in aid of the pension fund of the theatre in this orchestra's home city. Well, in the days when people still wrote letters to each other, the German violinist Ferdinand David must have been pleased when, in July 1838, he opened a letter from his old friend, which read, I'd like to write a violin concerto for you next winter. One in E minor sticks in my head, the beginning of which will not leave me in peace. Well, imagine just how pleased he must have been given that his friend was Felix Mendelssohn. David had to be very patient, though, because it took Mendelssohn 6 years to complete the concerto. He admired both David the man and his musicianship, and when he took over as conductor of the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra, he appointed David as its leader. They remained close friends and musical allies, and when Mendelssohn's health was a problem, David took over and fielded a lot of the routine activity of the Gewandhaus, where he spent 37 years altogether. Well, despite his gentle prodding to complete the violin concerto, as I say, Mendelssohn didn't get around to serious work on the score until the autumn of 1844. He worked closely with David and invited his suggestions both about the solo part and the suitability of the music as a vehicle for the violin. The two men shared a concern that the violin part should be executed with the greatest delicacy. And they both despised the kind of empty showpiece concerto of the early Romantic era that amounted to what Mendelssohn called a collection of juggler's tricks and rope dancer's feats. And now here is Ricardo Chailly with tonight's soloist Nikolai Znaider to perform Mendelssohn's violin concerto. Thank you. We've just heard Nikolai Znaider as the soloist with the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra, conducted by Ricardo Chailly in the violin concerto by Felix Mendelssohn. And I think you can tell from those cheers and the intensity of that applause, just how much the audience liked it here in the Albert Hall. Snyder wanting to take Maestro Shahi's hand and share the applause, but Shahi insisting that he take another bow himself. Well, Ferdinand David owned a 1742 Guarneri del Gesù violin. That's what he used at this concerto's premiere. That instrument was later owned by Jascha Heifetz and ended up, so Nikolai Snyder told me, in San Francisco. He plays a Guarneri del Gesù made the previous year, 1741, and he has it on extended loan from the Royal Danish Theatre. He's had it for 6 years now. It was owned by Fritz Kreisler, who he tells me absolutely loved the instrument and gave the premiere of the Elgar Violin Concerto on it. He played it between 1904 and 1918 and made a number of famous recordings. Snyder and Shahi holding hands and bowing, center stage. I asked him how he felt about the violin, and he says, it's like living with a very famous person who is also my partner. So it's not one thing or the other, it's both. In fact, when I went to speak to him in his dressing room, he held it up and said, it's a terrible looking old thing, isn't it? It certainly isn't. Here he is, on stage in the Albert Hall, bowing deeply. And retreating once again. A wonderful pair of giant German mitts applauding from the center of the promenade. I mean by that a pair of giant hands in the colors of the German flag. I think this is the kind of activity which may elicit what they're hoping for. A little word being exchanged here.
Thank you.
Well, as you heard him say, Bach, to be more precise, the gavotte from J.S. Bach's Partita number 3 in E major. Nikolai Znaider joking that he likes to stick to one key a night. Well, we've had one Mendelssohn UK premiere tonight already, the original version of the overture Ruy Blas, and after the interval, we've two more. The original version of the overture, the Fair Melusina, and likewise of Mendelssohn's Fifth Symphony, the Reformation. Nikolai Znaider applauding the audience now and giving them a cheerful thumbs up. A cheerful little wave as he leaves the platform for the last time. And it is time now for us to join Rana Mitter and his guest for tonight's Proms Plus Literary event, recorded earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music, just across the road from us here at the Royal Albert Hall.
Hello, and today our prom is dominated by that compelling figure of romantic music, Felix Mendelssohn. To tell us more about his life and work, Professor John Dethridge of King's College London joins me here. And we'll also hear readings from the actors Lisa Dillon, whom you'll know from television's wonderful Cranford, and Charles Aitken of the Royal Shakespeare Company. Now, John, one of the things we know about Mendelssohn is that he was a child prodigy, wasn't he?
Yes, there are a lot of child prodigies in music history, but he's unusual. Not like Mozart, his parents didn't actually want him to take up music, unlike Mozart, who was exploited. He also, by the time he was 14, had written over 200 compositions, and some of these are still played today. Now, you can't say that of all child prodigies. So
it's almost like sort of childhood rebellion, being told not to and deciding he was going
to
do it
yes,
anyway.
Well, yes, I mean, I think there is something rebellious about Mendelssohn, in the sense, if you have your dad telling you to study law and you say, no, Dad, I want to do music, and then actually getting away with it in the end. And also, by the way, his dad said you mustn't use the name Mendelssohn, even. Had visiting cards printed where it said Felix M. Bartholdy, and Felix said, no, sorry, it's got to be Mendelssohn Bartholdy.
And yet, in some ways, of course, the connections which his father made for him were of great importance. And I'm thinking here of a childhood meeting with one of the truly great figures of European culture, and that, of course, is Goethe, who I think he met aged 12. Mendelssohn aged 12, not Goethe aged 12.
Yes, yes. He first met him quite young, and Goethe was immediately impressed with him, because I think even at the age of 12, it was obvious that Mendelssohn had quite a lot of political cunning and knew who he was talking to, because Goethe found that he could actually have a conversation with this young person, and the more they met through the 1820s, then the more he realised that.
It's extraordinary to think of these two different phases of European culture sort of meeting during that brief period. And of course, one of the things that Mendelssohn was doing for Goethe was teaching him the history of music.
Yes, Goethe is someone who would talk about anything. I mean, if you read his voluminous collected writings, he even talks about his dentist at one point. But on music, he wrote quite a bit about music, but he always said he was a bit careful about talking about music. So he was particularly interested to hear from Felix, the first-rate Felix, as he called him, about the history of music.
Well, I think we've actually got a record of Goethe writing about one of these lessons in the history of music, and I think we can hear that now from Charles.
June 3rd, 1830. A few minutes ago, at 9:30 this morning, the first-rate Felix left after spending a cheerful fortnight with us and delighting everyone with his accomplished, lovable art. To me, his presence was especially beneficial, for I found that my relation to music is still the same as ever. I listen to it with pleasure, interest, and reflection, and I love the historical part of it. Who can understand any kind of occurrence if they are not thoroughly acquainted with its development down to the present time? What was great for me was that Felix understood this progressive advancement admirably, and luckily his excellent memory enables him to call before him at will every kind of example. Beginning with the Bach epoch, He brought Haydn, Mozart, and Gluck to life again for me, gave me a fairly good impression of the great masters of technique in more modern times, and finally led me to experience and contemplate his own compositions. And so he parted from me with my fervent blessing.
Now, what's going on there is something, John, that to us perhaps seems very familiar, which is the idea of trying to understand music through its history. And yet, at that time, this was actually rather an original thing to do.
Well, yes, it was unusual. The first thing is that Goethe is still learning, isn't he, at age 80. I think it's really quite remarkable. He wants to really know. And he's also picked up the idea, which was becoming current, that you can only understand music really, especially the latest, historically, that it comes from somewhere and he's making progress up to the present time. And I think he found that quite a good way of trying to understand music. He was very interested in the effect of music on people and knew that there was quite a lot to talk about it, but didn't think his literary abilities were enough always to talk about it. And you have Mendelssohn here playing the pedagogue, really, at the piano. He always love playing to people the piano and teaching them something about music, because he had so much music in his head that he could call on as well, as Goethe says.
I mean, this is something that really characterises Mendelssohn. He's someone who, at this point, in a very short number of years, really had a very strong engagement with, you know, the whole history, the legacy of the musical tradition.
Yes, I think he's one of the founders, really, of the idea of German music in the historical sense. And don't forget, by this point, he'd already introduced the St. Matthew Passion to a very distinguished audience in Berlin. And it put Mendelssohn on the map already as someone who was a Bach expert. But I have to say, he wasn't interested in Bach for antiquarian reasons. This is not someone who wants to do an authentic performance of Bach. In fact, it was with piano and with big chorus and so forth. He was interested, really, in doing older music in order to justify his own compositions, saying, I come from this tradition.
Well, that brings us to a very important point, I think, in terms of our assessment of Mendelssohn, because the accusation that is brought up against him, both at the time and in the centuries since, is that ultimately he fails to quite hit the top level of greatness because of an innate conservatism. I'm rather nervous seeing a whole bunch of Mendelssohn fans here in the audience, but I will risk putting that point of view. Do you think there's any fairness in that at all?
No, I don't think it's fair at all. I think he saw himself as a progressive, as someone who was carrying on from Beethoven, and I think he really did. I think this is a myth put out by a number of composers who came after Mendelssohn, including our friend Richard Wagner. But in fact, Mendelssohn, in the past few years even, is now, I think, more widely appreciated for doing really very innovative things, creating new forms and creating quite marvellous pieces. Good, he's uneven. You know, he can create the bad piece just like the next composer.
Well, speaking of innovation, one of the things that perhaps is less well known about Mendelssohn is that he loved to improvise to his friends at the piano, no doubt with some instruction in mind as well. And one of the people to whom he improvised was no less a personage than Queen Victoria. And we can actually hear a reading about this from Queen Victoria's diaries. Lisa.
6th of June, 1842, Buckingham Palace. After dinner came Mendelssohn Bartholdy, whose acquaintance I was so anxious to make. Albert had already seen him the other morning. He is short, dark, and Jewish-looking, delicate, and with a fine intellectual forehead. I should say he must be about 35 or 6. He is very pleasing and modest, and is greatly protected by the King of Prussia. He played, first of all, some of his Lieder ohne Worte, after which his serenade, and then he asked us to give him a theme upon which he could improvise. We gave him a Rule Britannia and the Austrian national anthem. He began immediately, and really, I have never heard anything so beautiful, the way in which he blended them both together and changed over from one to the other. Was quite wonderful, as well as the exquisite harmony and feeling he puts into the variations, and the powerful, rich chords and modulations which reminded me of all his beautiful compositions. At one moment, he played the Austrian national anthem with the right hand. He played Rule Britannia as the bass with his left. He made some further improvisations on well-known tunes and songs. We were all filled with the greatest admiration. Poor Mendelssohn was quite exhausted when he had done playing.
Lisa, thank you. And that reading was really so intriguing that we thought we couldn't resist asking John Dethridge if he wouldn't mind recreating that moment for us on the piano here. I'm sure Queen Victoria would have been delighted, John. Thank you so much.
That's a guess of what it might have sounded like.
Sounded very convincing to everyone here, I think. And actually, thinking back to that diary entry when she was describing that musical moment, I mean, this was a queen who really knew her music, wasn't she?
Oh, yes. I think she was something of an expert, played the piano herself with Albert. In fact, Mendelssohn arranged two of the Song Without Words for the both of them, and Queen Victoria has the simpler part at the top, and Albert has the bottom. But what's interesting when you play them is that Mendelssohn has done it in such a way that they keep touching hands. You have to keep touching hands with the thing as you go up the keyboard and down again. So he really knew about the intimacy of the two.
Now, a lot of Mendelssohn's music we think of as perhaps associated with a particular idea or image, I mean, Fingal's Cave, Hebrides, and so forth. But you've mentioned the Songs Without Words, the Lieder ohne Worte, and these, in a sense, are famous precisely for not being attached to words, to images in that way.
Yes. The idea may have come from his sister, actually, who had this idea of creating songs, but without a text. What is, I think, quite interesting is that these were very popular at the time, during Mendelssohn's lifetime, but sometimes people would write to him and say, well, what are you thinking? What were you thinking about when you wrote this music? Is there a text? And a relative of his, Suchet, who is the cousin of his wife, actually wrote him a long letter saying, what did you mean? And then suggesting some words to it. Mendelssohn's reply to this is really extremely interesting.
And we can hear that reply right now. Mendelssohn's letter to Marc-André Suchet, read for us by Charles.
Berlin, October 15th, 1842. There is so much talk about music, and yet so little is said. For my part, I believe that words do not suffice for such a purpose. And if I found they did suffice, I would finally have nothing more to do with music. People often complain that music is too ambiguous, that what they should think when they hear it is so unclear, whereas everyone understands words. With me, it is exactly the reverse. And not only with regard to an entire speech, but also with individual words. These two seem to me so ambiguous, so vague, so easily misunderstood in comparison to genuine music, which fills the soul with a thousand things better than words. The thoughts which are expressed to me by music that I love are not too indefinite to be put into words, but on the contrary, too definite. If you ask me what I was thinking of when I wrote my songs without words, I would say, just the songs as they stand.
John, how original at that time was this idea of music being more abstract, not being tied to any kind of image or particular idea?
It's not new, but mostly up to this point, it was generally agreed that music could be associated with something outside of itself. But what's interesting about this is that if you see it in a wider context, Mendelssohn is really prevaricating a little bit, because the truth is that he was someone who was always inspired by images and by words, always wanted to write an opera. He did write a 2.5-hour opera when he was younger, but he thought it was not very good, and he was absolutely right about that. He was a good critic of himself.
Am I right in thinking he actually walked out of the first performance?
He walked out of the first performance. He was so disgusted with his own opera. But that doesn't necessarily mean that he wasn't interested in writing one. And we know that he wrote many programmatic overtures, Fingal's Cave, where you almost can feel Mendelssohn getting seasick on the sea, can't you?
Now, speaking of the writing of operas, there is a very intriguing musical, What Might Have Been, Alternative History, because Mendelssohn did seriously consider writing an opera based on the myth of the Nibelungs. And we actually have a reading from his writing about that. Charles.
November 14th, 1840. My best thanks for your last letter. Do you know that your thoughts about the Nibelungen practically glow on the page? I haven't been able to get them out of my head since. I want to spend the first of my free days reading the poem. I've forgotten the details and can only recall the general outline and colouring of it, which seemed to me gloriously dramatic. Could you do me the favour of telling me your ideas in more detail? I scarcely remember what your allusion to the sinking into the Rhine stands for. Could you point out to me the various passages which struck you as particularly dramatic when the idea first occurred to you? And above all, could you be more specific about the whole concept, because its images and character have made a strong impression on my imagination? I beg you to do it, and do it soon. It will help me a great deal.
And if that the tone of that letter is shot through with deep love and affection, that's not surprising, because it was, in fact, written to Mendelssohn's sister, Fanny. And that idea of writing an opera was not just Felix, was it? She herself, Fanny, also thought about writing an opera.
I think it's clear from her reply, which we'll hear in a minute, that she herself was considering writing an opera on the Nibelungen, no less.
Well, in that case, I think we should turn to Lisa to hear the letter from Fanny to her brother Felix.
5th of December, 1840. I'm really glad about your lively interest in the Nibelungen idea. You're probably further along with your plans by now than I ever was. All I ever did was to think about the characters and the whole situation rather than a specific sequence of scenes. The greatest difficulty is probably the ending. No opera can end with such violent butchery. But how else? The sinking of the Nibelung horde goes like this. After Hagen has murdered Siegfried, he looks with envy on Krimhilde's great treasure, which, if I'm not mistaken, she has ordered to be brought from the land of the Nibelungs. Hagen is afraid that she'll use it to buy friends and avengers, so he snatches it away from her and sinks it into the Rhine. Please let me know now and then, how you're getting on with it all.
Well, the Mendelssohn ring, whether by Felix or by Fanny, was never to be, but history records that another guy, someone called Richard Wagner, did in fact make good on that particular story. And the other thing, of course, we know is that Wagner had strong opinions on Mendelssohn, and Mendelssohn's reputation has suffered because of Wagner's opinions, really, hasn't
it? Oh, yes.
It?
I mean, I think that these really quite perfidious arguments against Mendelssohn, that he was interested in old music, for example, because he couldn't write anything original by himself, and because he was a Jew, he therefore could only write imitations. But I think one of the factors here on Wagner's part, apart from the really terrible arguments, anti-Semitic arguments against him, is that he learnt a great deal from Mendelssohn and wanted to cover over that fact. He did the same with Italian opera, he did the same with Berlioz.
Well, for some people, knowing that someone has influenced you is clearly grounds for great resentment. It does sound as if that's what was happening with Wagner and Mendelssohn. I have to say that that is all we have time for tonight, but I'd like to say thank you very much to Professor John Dethridge and to our readers tonight, Charles Aitken and Lisa Dillon. Thank you all very much.
Rana Mitter presented this evening's Proms Plus literary event, and the producer was Gavin Hurd. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall. That chanting tells you where we are, and the second part of the first of a pair of concerts being given at the 2012 Proms by the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra and their music director, Ricardo Chailly. And they're going to give us the two more Mendelssohn UK premieres I mentioned earlier, with the original version of an unfairly neglected concert overture he considered the most intimate thing he produced, Die Schöne Melusine, followed by the original version of his Reformation Symphony. Well, earlier on, I asked Ricardo Chailly how it felt to inherit Mendelssohn's own orchestra.
It was certainly a privilege and at the same time a big responsibility. And I thought, in which way should I go, bringing forward such a long-lasting tradition? And at the same time, I finally had the opportunity to receive the first print of a new edition from Berlioz about the Urfassung and the early versions of Mendelssohn overtures and the symphony, especially the Reformation symphony, which we play tonight. Maestro Hogwood did take care of this critical edition, which are excellently printed, and that gave me the opportunity to reconsider my experience up to the time when I started, was 2005 in Leipzig, and restudy completely the whole series of overtures and symphonies of Mendelssohn in a complete different version, but at the same a complete different optical as interpreter. That was the fascination.
Ricardo Chailly, tonight's conductor. You do your best trying to give an account of a piece of music which you know your listeners can't know because it's brand new, and then the composer comes along and says that what you've said is a load of rubbish. Well, I'm glad to say that hasn't happened to me too often, but that was certainly how Mendelssohn described to his beloved sister Fanny what one German critic had to say about his overture, The Fair Melusine, going on about red coral, green sea beasts, magic castles and deep seas. The poor guy was only doing his best by a fairy story that probably then most Germans would at least have known. It's a story that's familiar to Germans, but not on this side of the Channel, though we might recognise Melusine as a relative of Dvořák's Rusalka. She's a water sprite who's allowed to marry a mortal on condition that she never reveals her true nature. She has to leave her knightly lover, Raimund, once a week to change back into mermaid form. And tragically, on one occasion, he catches her in the act. And this magical piece, Mendelssohn's watery imagery, gives us little foretastes of the rippling prelude to Wagner's opera, Das Rheingold. Here now is Ricardo Chailly to conduct the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra in Mendelssohn's overture, Die Schöne Melusine.
The Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra was conducted by Riccardo Chailly in the overture The Fair Melusine by Mendelssohn. And we heard there his original thoughts, reinstating a number of changes he made before the score came out in print in 1835. Riccardo Chailly returning to the platform and giving solo calls to the woodwind section. Well, for the final item in their programme, let's just get a little numbering thing out of the way. To begin with, Mendelssohn's Reformation Symphony was actually the second of his five mature symphonies for full orchestra that he composed. Immediately after it came the Italian. Well, they got numbered that way round because Mendelssohn didn't finish revising them until much later. That makes the symphony we're about to hear a work of his youth and not from later on in his short life. He died at just 38. Mendelssohn actually began work on the symphony when he was in Wales in September 1829, a few weeks after he made the first sketches for the Scottish Symphony during what was a very productive first visit to Britain. The Augsburg Confession, which the symphony commemorates, was the founding document of the Lutheran faith, which set out the principles of Protestantism in June 1530. In this symphony, Mendelssohn, who was a convert to Protestantism, presents a kind of programmatic account of the progress towards the triumph of the Reformation. The first movement evokes the solemn music of the Catholic Church, the serene style of Palestrina, without using a choir, of course. Then you find him apparently quoting from Wagner's Parsifal. It's actually the other way around. Mendelssohn brings in the Dresden Amen, which is now probably most familiar to us from Wagner's use of it as the Grail theme in his opera half a century after the premiere of Mendelssohn's Symphony. And to conduct Mendelssohn's Symphony No. 5, The Reformation, here is Riccardo Chailly. out of the many layered fabric of that glorious counterpoint, eventually soars triumphantly the chorale tune which began it, the Lutheran chorale, Ein fester Burg ist unser Gott, a safe stronghold is our God, with an eclat and solemnity perfectly suited to the occasion that that music was composed for, the 300th anniversary of the Augsburg Confession, the founding document of the Protestant faith. In what Mendelssohn called his Kirchensymphonie, his Symphony No. 5, the Reformation, we've just heard the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra conducted by their music director, Ricardo Chailly. And we've heard it for the first time in that form in this country, in its original version. 94 bars longer than the otherwise published version. Ricardo Chailly beaming broadly on the podium. One of my colleagues was approached earlier by a member of the orchestra who was wandering around on the platform before they came in for the rehearsal to begin. He pointed up to the bust which presides night after night in front of the organ console, gazing out from its vantage point over the hall, and said, "Who is this man?" That great roar is for the principal flautist of the Gewandhaus Orchestra, Katalin Steffeler. And a call for the oboist, Thomas Hipper, clarinetist, Thomas Zietsch, and bassoonist, Hans Schlag. As I say, he was soon set straight that this man was the conductor who started all this promenading palaver, Sir Henry Wood. And now the brass section taking a bow, the timpanist too, Matthias Müller, and now the entire orchestra. This orchestra is the oldest civic concert orchestra in the world, quite simply. And a couple of years ago, I read that they received the German Standards Brand Award, naming them Brand of the Century. You can't say fairer than that. Here is Ricardo Chailly once again, insisting that the orchestra stand, shaking hands with the leader, Christian Funke. Not often that the bravos begin when the piece is only halfway through, but there was one very enthusiastic Ronada, as you heard, who let out a great yell after the second movement. Well, they're not going to let them go easily. Wow, I can feel that resonating through the floor, even sitting up where I am. Here it is, Ricardo Chailly once again. Something of a misunderstanding, since he then dashed off the platform and seemed to disappoint expectations, but in fact that was only to bring on two extra players, a percussionist and a trumpeter. Thank you. Well, it wouldn't have been the same without those cymbal clashes, would it? A final calling card for this evening from this orchestra and its most illustrious previous music director, Felix Mendelssohn. You'll hardly need me to tell you that that was the wedding march from his incidental music for A Midsummer Night's Dream. And I think they liked it here in the Albert Hall. Here comes Ricardo Chailly once again. Well, tomorrow night's prom offers a programme which Ricardo Chailly tells me he's been wanting to present for several years. And he's very excited about performing it tomorrow, offering two very different perspectives on death, beginning with Ed Expecto Resurrectionem Mortuorum by the profoundly Catholic composer Olivier Messiaen, and in part two, Gustav Mahler's Sixth Symphony, whose thunderous hammer blows he came to believe would presage his own death. Ricardo Chailly and his technicians have been working hard on producing just the right effect, he told me. Two prototypes have been destroyed in the process. But tomorrow night, you'll be able to hear the third perfected version. That's at the usual time of 7:30. But for now, it's time for me to return you to John Shea in Broadcasting House.
Thank you very much to Donald MacLeod at the Royal Albert Hall. And before tomorrow night's second concert this weekend from the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra and Ricardo Chailly, we'll be back at the Albert Hall in the afternoon for the second of this weekend's organ recitals by Cameron Carpenter. That's at 4 o'clock tomorrow. Now, a word from Petroc Trelawney.
It might be a piece of music that you grew up with. Might be a piece of music you chose to be performed at your wedding or at a friend's party. Might be something taught you by a beloved piano teacher. Perhaps the first piece of music you heard live in concert. Whatever it is, we'd like you to tell us about it on Your Call. Your Call is a daily part of breakfast on BBC Radio 3. It's very simple. We talk to listeners on the air, on the phone, just for a couple of minutes and get them to tell us why a particular piece of music is so special to them. What piece of music would you choose? We'd love to hear from you. Free breakfast at bbc.co.uk. Tell us the piece of music that you choose for Your Call and be part of breakfast 7 days a week here on BBC Radio 3.
And Petroc will be here bright and early at 6:30 on Monday morning. Meanwhile, from 7 o'clock tomorrow morning, Martin Handley will be in the breakfast presenter's chair. Well, back to this Saturday evening here on Radio 3, and next, there's drama in The Wire. That's at 9:45. It's followed by the latest in new music in Here and Now at 10:30, and then Geoffrey Smith's Jazz at midnight turns its attention to music inspired by autumn. Well, it is the 1st of September, after all. So, before our drama in just under a quarter of an hour, let's hear some solo songs from 17th century Germany. One of the earliest publications of them is a 1627 collection by Johann Nauwach. He was a court composer of the Elector of Saxony. No prizes for guessing that love is the theme in both of these first two songs. In the first one, nightfall is a sad time for the poet as it deprives him of his lover. The second love song here is happier. The gist of it is Carpe Diem. Andreas Scholl is the singer.
Froh ist alles weit und breit, ich nur mich. Wir folgen Nüssen der Jahr.
Andreas Scholl singing two songs by Johann Nauwach. That was Ach liebste, lass uns eilen. And before it, Jetzt und kommt die Nacht herbei. Those songs from a disc of German Baroque songs that first came out in the 1990s, and it's recently been reissued by Harmonia Mundi. Well, those were two of the earliest songs on that disc. One of the latest is this one from the 1740s. The composer is Johann Valentin Goerner. It's called Die Nacht, and this time, night is a welcome guest.
Willkommen an den Leben Nacht, verhüllt in deine Schatten, die Freuden, die dich warten, und blend, oh blende den Verdacht.
Oh,
Andreas Scholl was singing Die Nacht by Johann Valentin Goerner. And I should mention his continuo players, the harpsichordist Markus Merkel, the lutenist Karl Ernst Schroeder, and in the earlier songs we heard a string ensemble led by Pablo Valletti. This is BBC Radio 3. We'll be entering the world of new music in performance when Ivan Hewitt is here with Here and Now. That's at 10:30. But now at 10:15, it's time for The Wire, Radio 3's drama series for new writing. Tonight's play is by Lavinia Murray, and it's called Ballad of the Burning Boy. It's an eco-thriller set in a disturbing dystopian future. We join Miriam in Preston as she longs for news of her missing teenage son.
Please, let it be George. Please, please, be George. Hello?
Miriam?
Speaking?
Mim?
What?
Mom.
Who is this?
Mommy.
Okay, you've had your kicks.
Don't put down the phone.
Oh, yes, braveheart. Number withheld. You gutless, flaming predator bastard. How did you do that? The volume control's on the outside of my phone.
Mim, Miriam, Mum, Mummy, you have 44 minutes to find your son and save him.
Yeah. So, you've read the posters. No George is missing. Clever you. Ghoul. Try ringing now, the plug's pulled. Oh, a frack.
Mrs. Lissick?
Who wants to know?
Dunno.
Are you a friend of George's?
Slightly.
Do you know where he is?
Nah.
Then why knock?
Bloke said to give you these matches. Arm come out of your edge when I was going past.
Okay. Give me the matches. I thought you lot went in for those little plastic lighters.
Ruffle.
Now clear off.
Arm was sticking out your edge. It had a man's voice, curly nails, long arm. It shoved me up the path. His fingertips were rubbing your window.
You know what? Go home. Not even a full box. Someone scribbled on it.
Burn me.
Oh, for goodness sake. Alice in Wonderland, the arsonist version. Burn me.
You have 42 minutes to find your son George before he disappears.
Fucking sugar! The match talks! Talks! Hello? Anyone there? Man in my hedge? Hope not. But someone has breathed on my window. Two little sparrows sitting on your wall. Fly away, Peter, fly away, Paul. Oh. Oh, horrible, horrible. More dead birds. Well, sorry, Peter and Paul. It's goodbye and into the bin. Any more? Yep. Know what? Birds dying. Sky every shade like it's petrol on a puddle. The world's gone weird, but even so, matches still don't speak.
They do, Miriam. You've got 40 minutes to find George before it's too late. Better run.
What the?
Try the city centre. Flag market. Come on. Chop, chop. Oh,
frack my fingers. Ah! Where to? Where should I go? Oh, George isn't here in the flag market, is he? No. Oh, my heart's yammering away. Sit down. The air feels like it's punching in my mouth. My lungs are hanging in my ribcage like two unripe cherries. We've all got asthma. Universal. The whole city's sucking on inhalers. What happened to the blue sky and the white clouds and the birds? What happened to just watching normal clouds in normal weather with George? Got caught up in something, haven't you, love? You and your friends. 3 weeks ago, one came round. Sweet Jesus, like a skeleton. Padlock round his neck on this thick, heavy chain. Like he'd locked himself into himself. Oh, George, George, George. Why didn't you take your mobile with you? Why don't you ring? There's enough telephone boxes. Oh, God, woman, just breathe.
Oi, Miss Lucy.
Oh, you again.
You better budge.
Says who?
Chop Chop.
Hey.
Matches. More matches. What do you see?
I see you dropping matches all over the flagstones.
Oh, crick crack. Crick crack.
Hey. Oh, there's a pattern. The matches have fallen like fish bones. A perfect skeletal fish. But that's impossible. Oh, well, the lad just chucked them. Are these matches like the others? Do they talk? Pity. I need clues.
I'll give you clues in return for justice, redress, retribution.
If only people left traces of themselves. Scattered, torn bread. No birds to vanish them. Oh, just something to follow.
Oh, Miriam. Miriam. Cities are like pockets. They collect a little bit of everything that's ever been in them. So does the land beneath. Listen. In the noise of the passing traffic, dinosaurs roar. And glaciers groan, and over them there's the clatter of looms and clogs. Nearer the surface, in the white noise of the wind, there is anger. Listen, that's the sound of the planet being hurled upside down, torn open, shaken, shaken and emptied.
Fish bones. Oh, the fish market's only around the corner. So what else could it be?
That's right, Mim. Walk past those post boxes and you're nearly there.
Four matches left. And I'm not going to waste them. These are for when I get stuck. I'm being goaded or tricked into using up wishes. I'm stuck in a wicked sort of fairy tale. Where somebody's stealing all the children. This is me, since George went missing. I wake up, walk round the house, see if he's come back. Bed slept in, him still in it. No. Bed is nearly outgrown. Place a row of seashells round the duvet edge. Tiny conches, cockle shells, mussels. Like it's a grave he can't get into. He can't die because the grave's closed. It's finished. Complete. Hope. Is hope superstitious? The thing is, the more you hope, the less convincing hope gets. So every morning I do this. For 12 years, I do this. I check my daughter's room. See if she's managed to stick to life. Clung on this time. See if she's in bed. If she's managed to get past being 5 years old. No. The last photo we took of her, she's blowing a little plastic windmill. It's spinning that fast, it's vanished. My daughter's a wind turbine. Kian and George and Beulah and me, we scattered her ashes under a wind turbine. Hey there, lovey, I said, and the blade swung round to face me. Hey there, lovey, my beautiful girl. Fly, wind, fly. There she is, her breath twirling the blades, ruffling the trees, shredding the clouds, lifting the airplanes. There she is, catching George and then letting him go. So, fish market, tell me where George is. And answer came there none. Hey, it's you again, Mr. Matches himself. What are you riding? Roller skate on a stick? Definitely skimped on the scooter to lad ratio. Any less scooter you'd be miming. Oh, hey! Hey! Come here, you!
What?
So what's with the matches? Who really gave them to you when you knocked?
I told you. Arm came out of your edge.
Why did you just chuck matches at me?
Habit.
You didn't see what the man looked like? His face?
Nah. But just now, right, I swear this head just came out of the metal grill on Miller's arcade. Leaves all over his chin, up his nose. He was rustling.
Ugh, sounds like you've been on the leaves yourself.
That's disrespectful. Don't jump about with conclusions when you know nothing about me, right?
Sorry. And it's jump to conclusions, not jump about.
You in charge of speaking, eh?
Did the face, head, whatever, say anything?
It was making loads of noise and spitting water like a fountain.
But did it say anything? Could it say anything?
Yeah. Gurgle, gurgle, boom!
Don't!
It said, tell Miriam to come to me. You Miriam, then?
Yeah.
See ya! Round the corner, at the phone boxes.
Hey, wait! Well, what's your name?
Puck.
Right. Thanks. As if. Puck?
You headed over to Miller's arcade, then?
Yeah. Well, it'd be a missed opportunity otherwise, wouldn't it?
You know all about those, Miss Livesey.
Oh, would I?
Yeah. Only don't let him mess with you. He knows where George is.
He knows? He knows? Come back! Well, you know something. Well, what do you know?
See ya. Come back to where you came. Pass me, Harry.
4 matches left. Should I light one? Yeah.
Do you want my blessing or my curse?
Oh, blessing, of course.
Do you want George to...
Ow! Rack on a rack. That's a match wasted. Lost. Kian. Oh, hello, love. I wasn't expecting a call.
You know I ring when I can, Mim. This is wild work. Where are you?
Well, I'm walking past the red phone boxes in the city centre. Looking.
Any sign of our prodigal son?
No. Nothing. There's something really wrong, Kian. I'm frightened.
You're always frightened of something, Mim. What did the police say?
They gave me a case reference number. Someone's calling round, but...
What?
This is our fault.
Don't go off on one of your mea culpa riffs. Keep a diary and it's evidence against yourself. Bloody hell, woman.
Oh, Kian, we've done this. Whatever's happening to our son...
Know what? You've got hypochondria of the conscience. Your conscience thinks it's done everything. You never used to be like this.
The birds are dying. There's loads in the garden every day. And asthma. Who hasn't got asthma? Damaging everywhere. Soiling our nest. We didn't do things when we could.
Like what?
We saw the warnings and we ignored them. Floods, droughts, gales. Everywhere's dying. Is it because we were too greedy? George kept telling us.
Look, I'm home next weekend. You're worn out.
We didn't do anything to stop it.
This is shit work. Hard, bloody nasty work. The sea's like a raving lunatic. Runs on random and the waves. Never used to be such crazy freaking waves.
Oh, no.
Everything's colliding.
Did you just put the phone down on me? Been away for 3 weeks, but everything's more unpredictable. Everything's dwindled since then. Even fewer cars. Erratic bus service, depending on whether they've fuel. And supermarket shelves, one packet thin. Last week, people were panic buying bin bags. I'm scared of how the world's going. I'm very, very scared.
And so you should be, Miriam Livesey. The guy with leaves on his face and a fountain flowing from his mouth. Well, he might be some sort of a god, but he's a sad-eyed, dying with the dusk sort of a god.
It's Preston City, but I may as well be wandering the wide world trying to find George.
Fetch me a gift. Give me the song that you sang to your children.
If a grain of salt was a little seed, what would it be? It would be this. After one day, there'd be a breeze. After 2 days, a drop of water. After 1 week, a roaring wave. And on its peak,
a little ship, and on the ship, three merry sailors, Beulah, Umbriony, and George.
Oh, there's the bench I started from. Across the road at the corner. Is that it? That ornate iron grill?
Miriam Livesey.
Oh, there really is some bloke there. Hey, I can't quite see you. Are you lurking in the shadows on purpose?
I am part shadow.
Is that a metaphor for being shy?
No, it's part of being some sort of a god.
Like Pan. Pan, the civic hanging baskets man. So, should I light a match? Is that what I do? I mean, it's a bit votive, isn't it?
Not this time, Miriam Livesey. I have a story about starfish. It might go this way or it might go that. The dice I'm rolling is a starless sky. Beneath the starless sky is an ocean bright with starfish, and every starfish holds a lullaby, a cradle song, a cradle into grave song. Starfish cartwheels over the ocean floor till it finds a bed of oysters, and it picks one. Then, twirling on one point, like a bread-crumbed ballerina, it cradles the chosen oyster and then embraces it. Such a sweet hug. It has the tenderness of death about it. Such a hug, it opens up the oyster. Such a hug, and out comes its soft little stomach on its fine long leash. And the starfish hugs and caresses and comforts the oyster as it gobbles up what is mortal and leaves a space for everlasting. They practice and practice, and each starfish learns the perfect way to close a life and open up forevermore. And the starfish is how death comes to all. If a grain of salt was a little seed, what would it be? It would be this.
You have my song.
I have your song. I have the names of your children. I don't know the name of the new child, the grandchild, the one about to be born.
It doesn't have a name.
Would you tell me if you knew?
No. I would never tell you.
Look for George at Richard Arkwright's house by St. John's Minster. It's a lovely spot. You can sometimes hear birdsong in his garden. The pre-Arkwrights gather there every night. The pure in heart, in intent, the ones who have elected to be lost, the sacrificial lambs, and the man who powers the slaughter lines. I'm collecting your children, one by one, taking them. A sky for a sky, a child for the children of every ruined species. Justice, redress, retribution, the naming of names.
Well, you better not go after my kids, because...
Yes?
I'll come after you. And what are the pre-Arkwrights?
Arkwright and pre-Arkwright. Call and response. History and a future furious with the past. Cross over Church Street, head for the spire on your left and walk down the side all the way to the bottom. You have 18 minutes before George...
Before he what?
Before George chooses.
George went on a hunger strike. Got others involved. Have the school canteen full of kids sitting through lunch hour. No queues at the canteen counter. Everyone sat at the tables, glass of water instead of plates. Nobody speaking. Just the click of tumblers being lifted and set back down. Just the scattered raising of glasses to lips and sipping. Dinner lady checking the food. Taking a little pat from each of the hot plates. Dipping a ladle into the serving trays. What's wrong with our food? Headmistress marching in, taking a plate, scooping up a mishmash and sitting down dead centre and making a clatter of a cutlery while she shoveled it in. Back for more portions, a little of everything. A fruity belch and she colours up. Detention for the few who sniggered. Then in the afternoon, teachers asking why, asking who was behind it. Kids holding up newspaper cuttings, humanitarian disasters, freak weather, drowned polar bears. George had videoed it. He still used his mobile back then. George videoed it. The idea was to have it spread, the refusal of food. But then I started to get visits from... Well, they weren't police. They asked altogether cleverer questions.
Miriam Livesey, turn down the side of the minster. You'll find Arkwright himself down the bottom on the left.
Oh, Kian?
Sorry, love. But you thought I switched you off.
Yeah, I did.
Signal went. The communication satellite took a hit from space debris. Bound to happen, the amount of junk orbiting Earth. But, Mim, one of the things I've always loved about you is your conscience. But nothing we've done has led to this.
But it's cumulative. Like when you vote, you push something along.
Listen, it's not you. Take this for example. Water's thick with starfish. They're like rats, vermin. Eat everything in their path. Put your hand in and they grab. Sorry, I forgot. I'm ragged. How's Beulah?
Worried about a brother. Uncomfortable. Enormous. Oh, love. Me and you, grandparents. Us. George will be an uncle.
He'll be back for that.
That's what Beulah said. What's that? Kian? What's happening?
Just got a kickback from a pocket of gas. It's happening a lot. Have to go. Drill shack's full of Mr. Angry's. Bye, Mim.
Kian? You've left your phone on. Oh, well. Pay as you go. It'll run out. Yeah. Like everything else, it'll run out.
And they lower a fishing net under the ship, and they'd haul it up with last month's rain, and they'd try it again and again and again, and up would come an old silver spoon. Beulah and Bryony and George would cry, "Mom, it's the moon."
No, not St. John's house, not the Christian Scientists. The tall brick building, a house fit for Arkwright, a giant amongst men. Cities are pockets of caves. People are cave dwellers that upped and dragged their caves along with them, piling them onto grasslands and forests, slamming them next to and on top of rivers. Then one day, not long ago, your shadows turned into pavements, but the bones beneath and the bones above are dancing together and dancing together, and where they rub, they're catching fire. If a tree falls in a forest and there are only loggers with a chainsaw present, does anyone hear it? Can you see him? A great man at the gateway of his great man's house. Gather in the shadow of the tree.
So many young men and women. All so thin and fierce.
My name is Richard Arkwright, and I think I am a type of god. This is what happened. I drove a rust bucket, a long time or a short time, and the wheel jack in the footwell bounced against the cracking metal.
Crick crack!
Every pothole, thump and thwack worked to split the back end of the car from the front.
Crick crack!
And so it happened.
Crick crack!
I was left with half a car, and this half a car was so light, the speed I was travelling threw me skyward, lobbing me straight into heaven.
Crick crack!
In heaven, petrol was cheap, but the cost of conscience was oh so dear, so I reversed home and set to work.
Crick crack!
Believe me, I gathered all the conscience I could find, pried it away from every situation, and oh, it was an easy pluck.
Crick crack!
Then I sped back to heaven in my half a car and exchanged conscience for petrol, the deal entirely in my favour.
Crick crack!
My name is Richard Arkwright, and my soul sticks to the combustion engine like a pearl to grit.
Crick crack!
Layer upon layer, such a treasure. But who would have thought that all heaven's store of petrol would run dry? Doesn't heaven deal in infinities and eternities? Oh, I am dumbfounded. I recycled my half a car. into iron shoes.
Rip-rap!
The pre-Arkwrights wear them.
Rip-rap!
My story ends when the last pair has worn away to foil.
Rip-rap!
Every car is a dragon burning up the countryside with its smoking breath. Every car is a dragon eating its weight in maidens and youths.
Justice, redemption, redress, reparation.
I choose! That girl has caught light. She's burning. Why the frig is no one trying to help her?
And out as quickly as a birthday candle.
Oh, sweet Lord.
Like she was magnesium.
She said, I choose. There's nothing but a faint shadow on the pavement to show she was ever here. This is an act of will, sacrifice, suicide. George doesn't have to die.
Yeah, it's a decision.
Follow them, Miriam, follow. Turn right at Shepherd Street, then right again down the main drag. You're on Avonham Way. Broom, broom, follow. Put on a turn of speed.
Moon with a moonbeam that wouldn't let go. Goodbye. The three small sailors would say goodbye. Bueller and Brian, and George. They turn about with the ship gently rocking and return to a speck of salt in my hand.
None of them have to die.
My mother killed me, my father ain't me, my little sister Brian, he gathered all my bones and sop and wrapped me in the tablecloth, stashed me beneath the privet hedge, chirruped, whee! What a beautiful bird am I.
You have two matches waiting in the matchbox. Oh, Miriam Livesey, you've played with fire all your life.
I'll find George. I'll save him.
Left it a bit late, Mrs. Livesey.
Thing is, Miriam Livesey, George is braver than you ever were. George can see more than you ever saw. George is alive to everything, but not for long. Not for long.
Nothing is going to happen to my son. Actually, yes. Life is going to happen to my son. The future is going to happen to my son.
Oh, where have you been, George Livesey, my son? Oh, where have you been, my handsome young man? I've been to the wild wood, mother. Make my bed soon, for I'm wearied of recycling and fain would lie down.
The day George disappeared, after I knew he wasn't coming home that night, I stuffed my pockets with every animal adoption certificate he'd ever bought. Oh, God, he's got hundreds, right? Every bit of money he got went into saving species and habitats. So I fetched them with me. I waved them about like they were IOUs. Proof that he'd been kind, proof that he deserved help. They were my last bits of hope. Skewed hope. Hope that didn't make sense, but what else had I got? So I went to the park and I shouted, animals, birds, George helped you. Now come and help him. Please.
Past the car park, Miriam. Down Syke Street. Off you go.
But people don't help people because, well, they don't. Strings attached. But animals help people. The dolphin carrying the child to safety when they've fallen in the sea. Wolves rearing lost children. Guide dogs, hearing dogs, horses. That war horse. Police horses. Family pets. Getting people out of rivers and burning houses and finding landmines. It happens. Gorilla with a pet cat. Greyhound suckling tiger cubs. Life helping life. And kindness. Kindness happening. So I waved the adoption certificates in the air. George helped you, please. Help George.
That's nuts, Miss Livesey.
Birds fluttered down, they sang. They thrashed about against my shins, and then they fracking well died. I carried on walking and waving my arms. Birds swooped, sang, and thrashed about on car bonnets. They all sang, even after they'd stopped moving. The song came out of them. I said, what's this? A dead bird's chorus. I may as well have been death waving a scythe about, not a mum with bits of paper. Then, there were people all over the park with their dogs on leads. Everyone dragging their dogs. Dogs on their backs with tongs lolling, eyes shut, legs stuck out, all of them howling, dead, stiff. And howling.
Oh, where have you been, George Livesey, my son? And where have you been, my handsome young man? I've been to the Wildwood, mother. Make my bed soon, for I'm weary with prophecy and fain would lie down.
You're at a crossroads, Miriam. Turn your back on Booth's Bridge. Cross right onto Cross Street. Now you're off to Winkley Square. Hurry.
Look at these certificates. So many beasts and birds. George helped you! Now, please help George. I mean, we mapped their DNA. We used snippets of them and made our own versions. We've done that to dogs and cattle, picking and choosing and shaping. Maybe that's what made us think that we could do it to everything. Listen. Sun bear and pelican, Tasmanian devils times three, an eye, 12 platypuses, a beluga whale, giant anteater, cloud leopard, hippopotamus, arctic hare, and that's just for starters. Oh, God, help us. There's nothing left to help him. He's so angry that his dad works at the oil rigs.
His mother gathered up the gobbets, the hack and the hocks of him, all sundered and churning in the drill wild water. His mother grabbed at his backbone, his ribs, his arms, feet, fingers, shins, toes, elbow, his shoulders and thighs, every sop, both spill and splinter. She scrabbled against the twisting tide for the lumps of his skull, the hulled heart and the blenched lungs and the threads that had carried his blood. His mother gathered up what the oil rig drill had broken, and she spoke him back to life. She spoke him back to life so he could make his choice.
I bought George an acre of moon. I bought Beulah an acre of Venus. Unspoiled planets, both shine. Planets that maybe we'll colonize. All things are possible.
You bought your children an acre of moon, an acre of Venus. All the nations on Earth bought an acre of sun. Here on Earth, they stored their acres of sun. They made it a bomb, their acre of sun, and it's ready to drop, the acre of sun, ready to burn, an acre of sun. Will it keep the world safe, an acre of sun? Will it burn the world down, an acre of sun? What sound will it make, those acres of sun? How high are the flames from that acre of sun? Shadows will fall from the acre of sun and never get up from the acre of sun. Hiroshima, Nagasaki, are acres of sun. Bikini, atolls, an acre of sun.
I feel as if the world's coming to an end.
Oh, Miriam, it is. What's nature when we unpack it? Messy, unpredictable. So, Winkley Square. Sir Robert Peel with his back to the dead forest and his eyes on you.
Yes, yes, they're here. The pre-Arkwrights are here. Seems as if I'm watching them through a thermal imaging camera. Oh, they're glowing. Their bodies are fluid runs of blue and red and yellow. Petrol on puddles.
Fireflies, innit? Swarms of them.
Fireflies.
Firebirds. Firecrackers.
Children. They're children.
Firelighters. Tinder. Fuel.
There are hundreds of shadows on the flagstone, shadows with drifts of ash flowing out of them.
My mother killed me, and my father ate me. My little sister Bryony gathered all my bones, wrapped them in a tablecloth, stashed them under the privet hedge, chirrup, weep. What a beautiful bird am I.
This is the dead forest. For every tree in Preston City, there are dead trees in the earth below their roots. Dead trees outnumber living trees. Dead trees with centuries of sunlight shut inside them. The corpse of sunlight in the carcasses of trees. The dead within the dead, and all the dead birds to flit between the dead branches. Chirrup, cheep, what a beautiful bird am I, they sing, while the shadow children wander the cinder paths between.
Is he here? George! George! Please, please. Have any of you seen George? Is he here? Is George Livesey here? I bought him an acre of moon. No, don't run away! Let me help you. I saw just now. Let me help you. You don't need to die. Please, help me find George. 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 George.
Stop. Strike a match. You have two left. Strike one now while you're in the dead forest. Then I'll help you.
Matchbox. Well, where's the flaming matchbox? Like one of these matchsticks. Oh, my hands. Don't make a mess of this woman. Light the match. Light it.
If you want to reach George before he's made his final decision...
What do I have to do?
Set your sleeve alight. Put the flame beneath your sleeve and let it have a little feed. Quick, before it's out.
No. You're being cruel.
Last chance to let the flame bite.
Sweet Lord. Freck.
Miriam, your name means starfish. You have such a predatory grip on life. You have to learn to let go. Miriam Starfish, this will lessen your grasp.
Oh, please. Oh, the fire. Oh, it's spreading.
Isn't that typical? Fire is such a nosy thing. It looks, it learns.
Please, tell me what I can do. If I need to burn to death instead of George, then I will. I'll die right now. Let my son live. Tell me, can I die instead of George?
It's not always. Accept no substitute.
He's in Avonham Park. He's making his decision. He's made his decision. Miriam Starfish, could you hug the flames from his body?
I could.
Could you change the world?
I could.
You didn't.
Out, flames! Out!
Now, Miriam, out of the square and across to the post boxes. To the right is the city centre. To the left is the park. George is waiting for you there. You will set him alight, not with a match, but with what you have done. You and your generation have been blessed with the children you wished for. Your children are the fuel you dreamed of. Look down, Miriam. How much has this cost? How many Hiroshima shadows do you see? These are the children who chose to die, braver than you, lives put to more purpose than yours, beautiful living things spent.
I'm sorry. I'm so, so sorry.
What is the price of life?
You can't put a price on life.
Humans do. Every child is a unit of fuel.
The pavement's full of shadows.
They were children. They are the end of the fuel crisis.
Where is George? Is George here?
You drove, you bought, you wasted, you poisoned, you burned, you frittered, you ignored. Miriam Starfish.
I'd get it if I were you, Mrs. Livesey. Could be important.
What is it?
It's private.
It's a text from Beulah.
And is it good news? Is it good news? Is it something to lighten your darkness, Miriam Starfish?
I'm a grandmother. Beulah's given birth to a baby girl.
And what has she called her? What is the name of this brand new life?
Bryony Rose.
Fuel to burn.
No. No. No, 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 no! No!
We are the light. We are the light. We choose to die for what is right. We are Christ. We are the light. Sick rose, sick sky, sick day, sick night. We are Christ. We are the light. We are the light.
world is coming to an end.
Please. Have any of you seen George?
Firelight.
Is he here?
Tyndall.
Is George Lucy here?
You have to learn to let go.
We are the light. The next war's fought for third world kids. They'll be the GA's power grids. We are light. We are the light.
We are the light.
No, said the woman, jumping to her feet. And with her hair standing up like flames of fire.
Tell me.
Could you hug the flames from his body? Your birth star is starfish. Your life star is starfish. Your legacy is starfish.
George!
Tried and tried.
George! You children are my life. I'd die for you. I love you. Please, please come home with me.
No, Mum.
Let me die in your stead. This is about witnessing. About being martyrs, isn't it? Isn't it?
Yes.
Then let me tell you. A big part of this is your hormones. It's about growing up. Everything's intense. I remember. This'll pass. Believe me. Come home. Live a good life. Put right everything that's wrong. Use your life to leave a legacy.
Like you did.
Oh, I can change. You can show me. And you're an uncle. Beulah's just had a baby girl. Oh, come and see her with me. Come on, love.
You haven't understood what's happened, Mum.
I've tried. I'm trying.
We've been born with the power to combust. Spontaneous human combustion controlled by self-will. When we burn, we leave no trace. The ash is from our clothes. We are the perfect fuel. We'll be exploited. We won't be given the chance to live. We'll cause wars. Pollution has made us evolve into this.
You can choose to stay alive.
I can choose.
The one remaining match, quick. Quick.
I choose. I choose. No. I choose.
No shortages of fuel for all eternity. An infinity of things for all of eternity. George powers the city. George and his friends. George and his peers. George and his generation. George and all those born in the years since. George and all those children sticking their heads into the world for the first time. Now. Such power in them, such force. Such punch. And all they leave behind is a tiny smudge. All they are is light and heat. And they burn, and they burn, and they burn for millennia. I do believe I'm something of a dying god.
In Ballad of the Burning Boy by Lavinia Murray, Miriam was Saran Jones, the narrator was Lem Sisse, Puck was Chris Finnegan, and Kian was Phil Corbell. Original music was by John Nichols, and the director was Melanie Harris. Ballad of the Burning Boy was a Sparklab production for The Wire on BBC Radio 3.
There's more drama on Radio 3 next weekend, when Drama on 3 tomorrow week is Mike Walker's play The Product, set in Vietnam shortly before Richard Nixon's election in 1968. That's our Drama on 3 on Sunday of next weekend, the 9th of September, at 8:30 in the evening.
The 2012 BBC Proms season goes out with a bang. On the two nights before the last night, a pair of BBC Proms concerts with the Vienna Philharmonic and Bernard Haitink. Haydn, Strauss, Bruckner, and Beethoven's Fourth Piano Concerto, played by Murray Pariah. The Vienna Philharmonic at the BBC Proms. Thursday and Friday nights at 7 and 7:30 on BBC Radio 3.
And Martin Handley is the lucky man presenting those concerts. Geoffrey Smith's Jazz is on the air at 12 midnight, but now at just after 10:30 here on Radio 3, it's time for Here and Now, our weekly look at the world of new music in performance. It's presented by Ivan Hewitt.
Hello, and welcome to a programme of new pieces made entirely on keyboards, but not the usual ones played with fingers on ivory. These are played on big keyboards made of steel and wood and played with mallets wielded by the whole arm. They're played by Percussion Clavier de Lyon, the percussive keyboards of Lyon. They're a group of five percussionists who play marimbas, xylophones, vibraphones and glockenspiels, as well as anything else that can be struck by a mallet or stick that the composer might ask for. On this occasion, they included temple blocks, cymbals and an ancient Mexican percussion instrument called the teponazli. The occasion was a concert given in King's Place in London back in May, when the quintet performed four of the many dozens of pieces they've commissioned since they first got together back in 1983. We're going to hear three of them, beginning with Rigaudon by François Narbonne, a 50-year-old French composer who in his youth was more interested in jazz than classical music. That old enthusiasm peeps through occasionally in this piece, which is scored for all five players, divided between two vibraphones, two marimbas, and a bass marimba player. The composer doesn't tell us about the meaning of the title, but he does tell us that the piece is an attempt to reinvent the piano touch of Debussy in a different medium. And not just the touch, but also the way Debussy's music is shot through with that special sort of harmonic ambiguity that takes on a feeling of memory. Here now is Rigaudon, performed by Percussion Clavier de Lyon.
Thank you.
Rigaudon by François Narboni, performed by Percussion Clavier de Lyon. Their next piece came from a composer the group has worked with for many years, Gavin Bryars. Some years back, Gavin Bryars worked with a miscellaneous group of musicians on a project to explore the music of Tom Waits. The idea was to create musical commentaries on Tom Waits' sad, nostalgic songs in a completely different sound world composed of harmoniums, accordions, musical saw and pianos. Bryars tells us that this piece for percussion, which is entitled At Portage and Main, has something of the same quality of an extended song, embedded in an ensemble that at first sight doesn't seem at all suited to it. In fact, the song takes quite a while to emerge. That's in the first part of the piece. The second shorter section is an evocation of a particular place. It's the corner of Portage and Main Street in Winnipeg, a city Bryars has spent much time in. Why that particular street corner? Because it's officially the coldest street on the North American continent, and so for Bryars seems to embody something about the idea of north. In fact, it's so cold there's actually a bylaw forbidding anyone from crossing at street level in winter. Gavin Bryars's At Portage and Main is performed by Percussion Clavier de Lyon.